big thing.
A big show.
Yeah. Yeah.
What did you feel about your prospects at this point?
Well, I mean, you know, there was the disappointment of that. On the other hand, there was the satisfaction of graduation, you know, yes. Achieving, you know, passing out, you know, satisfying all the professors and not flunking French or German or Latin or something.
Did many fellows wash out at all or get out? Not make it, I guess is the term.
We lost about three, I guess, at the end of the first year. And I won't mention names. We didn't lose anybody at the end of the second year. There were a few narrow squeaks, you know. and I think maybe if you look back, you could say, well, if the war hadn't been on,
there might have been
half a dozen who, in fact, didn't make it. But but I think that our professors, and I think without exception, the difficulties were not in the naval subjects so much as in some of the academics. I mean, I'll say about myself, for instance, the second year we had analytical chemistry, and at the Christmas exam, I think I stood about middle of the class with 14%, and that was pretty agonizing. You know, we only had another 4 months, 5 months to go, and you had to somehow jack that up a bit, you know.
That's 50, eh?
So there were some tense times, but as I say, mostly in the academics. But on the other hand, as I say, it was a pretty heavy program because you had a pretty normal full academic schedule of about five subjects, and then the naval one superimposed.
You were given a diploma, I guess.
You had a first, second, or pass certificate when you graduated.
This did not ensure commission, is that correct?
Oh, yeah.
Or it did ensure commission?
This ensured commission in that when you graduated from Royal Roads, you were promoted to a midshipman.
Mm-hmm.
But a midshipman, of course, is not a commissioned officer. You still then had another 20 months to serve as a midshipman at sea when you became an acting sub-lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
When you did another series of courses, which were all of the naval nature, and at the end of, and you were, and an acting sub-lieutenant was not a commissioned officer.
Not until
you were a confirmed sub-lieutenant. To become a confirmed sub-lieutenant, and I can't remember the exact details, but there was I think it was 2 years as an acting sub-lieutenant, less time earned for achievement on your technical courses. And again, that's with courses in gunnery and communication, and so on and so forth and so forth. And you've got so many months off for a first class pass, so many for second, and so many for third. And then you've got so many for passing your midshipman seamanship board, and you even got, I don't know, a couple of weeks for the results of your midshipman's journal.
Mm-hmm.
So you took 24 months less the time earned, and that equaled the time you served as an acting sub-lieutenant before you got promoted to a confirmed sub-lieutenant.
This is a policy prior to the war also, is that correct? Or not prior to the war, we didn't have our own in Canada, but I understand, like, I was talking, this is Admiral Lear or Admiral Murdoch, one of the two was telling me that, because Admiral Lear was saying that you were to be a midshipman for so long, and then you were to be a acting sub-lieutenant, and then a full sub-lieutenant, and then if you were very, very good, and you became a naval lieutenant, or an army captain, equivalent, that you would be that for 8 years.
That's right.
It didn't matter hell or high water.
Yeah.
The war was not going to interrupt this whole system.
Oh, no.
And
the regular force training, permanent force officer training, of the cadet, the midshipman, the acting sub, and the sub, motored on regardless of the war. It changed slightly in that the sub-lieutenant's courses, as they were known, were shortened during the war. After the war, when they went back to the pre-war system, in fact, that lasted 18 months, of which 9 months were at the Royal Naval College at Greenwich, which was another session of academics. It was almost like a junior staff course, and 9 months of the naval subjects, or the technical courses, gunnery, torpedo, and so on. During the war, or immediately after the war, and in the latter part of the war, they cut out the Greenwich time. So that made the subs courses 9 months. at the heat of the war, the heart of the, or the peak of the war, they reduced subs courses down to about 5 months. But they still had them.
Midshipmen
still did 20 months. And you still did so many months as an acting sub-lieutenant.
But there was no reversion after that fact, is that correct?
No. You didn't.
Whereas a lot of fellows...
A lot of the reserves, when they transferred to permanent, then lost seniority and even dropped back a rank. But the small... See, the permanent force was really quite small in numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And so this little core within the... By this time, the very large RCN, per se, this very small permanent force core, they kept their training system sacrosanct. And all hell could be breaking loose around you, but that lot drove on right down through the middle. And other than minor adjustments in time, duration, of course,
mm-hmm.
it didn't waver at all.
Did you ever question your decision at that point? Because, as you state, your fellows that are in the reserves were up in rank and involved.
No, not at that point in time, because,
late in the war?
We were, the war was on, and we were still under training, and that you hadn't, you didn't, and we didn't really become that closely involved with the RCNVR. Because when we left Royal Roads, and I think I said it was 30 permanent and 20 reserves. I'm sorry, that's the other way around. It was about 20 permanent force and 30 reserve. Right. Now, of the 20, they split us pretty well right down the middle of my particular class. Half of the guys went to HMCS Uganda, and that was the cruiser which the Royal Navy had transferred to the RCN, lock, stock, and barrel. And she, by this time, was in Charleston, South Carolina, being refitted after being smashed up in some operation. So half my class went there. And again, in good naval style, they took it alphabetically, and the early part of the alphabet went to Uganda. The back end of the alphabet went over to the Royal Navy for training.
As midshipmen.
Because the training system, the permanent force training system, said midshipmen will do their midshipmen sea time in big ships, cruisers and above. The RCN only had one cruiser. My senior term, when it graduated, the RCN had no cruisers, so they all went to the Royal Navy. And in any Royal Naval gunroom at that period in time, you would have a mixed bag of course, predominantly Brits, but Canadians, and Australians,
New Zealand,
and all the Commonwealth there, because we all had the same basic system.
Right.
And midshipmen went to sea in big ships, and it was the luck of the draw of where you went.
But the only difference would be the buttons, I guess, on your uniform.
Yeah. And we wore Canada on the shoulder, and they wore Australian, and that was Australian, and so on.
Buttons and patches,
yeah.
That was it.
That's it. Excuse me.
There goes the buzzer. We're back again here.
Our group sort of split.
Mm-hmm.
So that, as I say, half the class went to Uganda and Charleston, and the other half of us went over to the UK in the dear old Aquitania with, 7,000 other troops or something.
So you weren't going to go over on a destroyer or convoy duty or any of that business
we
at
were
all?
Just
you were
shipped
just
straight over to UK.
You were just luggage.
Loaned to the Royal Navy for training. Was sort of our status. Loaned to the Royal Navy.
Well, how did you feel getting going over?
Thrilled, excited. Oh, yeah.
Were you part of ship's company? Were you part of the watcher? Were you strictly passengers?
No, we were in fact given ship's duties. She was a troop ship, and I think we had something like 7,000 troops on board. Most of us were lucky, and we in fact were given the what they call the upper deck patrol duties, which was to be on the upper deck and sort of 2-hour watches and make sure that no lights were showing, nobody came out and lit cigarettes and
mm-hmm.
this sort of thing. A few of our people got the more distasteful job of being troop deck officers, and it means you could have been in the bowels of the ship with maybe 150 troops crammed into a little troop deck. And I think, you know, a pre-war cabin that was probably designed for two would have eight, that sort of thing. But at least we had a cabin, you know.
We had a cabin.
Which, you know, for a midshipman was all right, you know. It wasn't that bad. Now, as it, by coincidence, at the end of the war, and after I'd done my subs courses and came back to Canada in 1947, came back in the Aquitania. But by this time, she'd been converted back to passenger, although she wasn't in all her glory, but I mean, she was now carrying passengers, mostly war brides, of course, coming mm-hmm. back out to this country. And so we had a slightly more pleasant, you know, there were only like four to a cabin coming back. But it was the same old ship.
You had a bed.
Yeah,
right. Let me tell you my problems, sir. That's great.
So, let's say, so I was one of the group that went over to UK for training.
Now this is August 44.
This was August 44, yeah.
Or September, early September, August.
Well, we got promoted.
Got promoted in August. 40.
Got promoted in August, 1st of August 44. And see if my crib sheet tells me here. 25th of August, we reported to Halifax. Sailed from Halifax on the 29th of August, 1944. 8,000 troops aboard, including the largest RCAF and RAF draft to proceed overseas since the beginning of the war.
This is all part of your midshipman's log.
Journal.
Yeah. Ship has a log.
Right. Yeah, midshipmen have journals.
I'll get it right, yeah. No, we have unification now. I can get it right. How does it feel to be called a colonel and being a Navy man?
A bit shuddering at times.
The bug.
I sometimes sort of have to hear it twice before I realize it's not talking to me. No, I took it, I think, in good stride. I was lucky in that I served 2 years on the staff at RMC in 49-50, which was an army-administered mm-hmm. college. So I got to know a lot of soldiers and understand the language a bit and so on. And then I did my staff college with the RCAF in Toronto in 1962, so I had a year with the Air Force and got to know the language and a lot of the guys. So coming together really wasn't a strange thing in any way, shape, or form. But I was lucky because, you know, as I say, I a couple of times got out of the normal sort of Halifax, Ottawa, or Ottawa, Esquimalt naval circuit and sort of broke loose into rather different directions.
Still go by your naval rank that's here?
Out here, because it's in the maritime command doing a maritime thing. But, you know, for example, when I fly on the military aircraft on duty, I always call myself a colonel, and it doesn't bother me. But on the other hand, it makes it much easier for the air movement personnel, because when they look on the, you know, they want to get hold of me and they say Colonel Shaw, they know who they're getting, you know. If you were to say Captain Shaw, they wouldn't know whether you're getting two striper in which they say, hey, you do so-and-so, or
yes, hey, you sir, Captain
do so-and-so, you know.
Who told me was it? There's a hey, you Captain, and a yes, sir, Captain.
That's right.
Yes, sir, Captain. Right. That's great. You get to England in 44. You're with the Royal Navy. The war is, I guess you could say the tide has turned.
Mm-hmm.
You realize it's a matter of time at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was pretty apparent to all of us that, you know, it wasn't going to drag on that much longer. But I don't think, certainly I didn't really estimate it was going to end in the spring of 45. But, you know, mm-hmm. obviously the end was in sight, you know, and, you know, just reading the newspapers alone, you know,
yes.
The movement of the troops through Europe and so on.
Did you see any action at all at this point? Are we strictly in...
No. Well, I have, you know... Let me just sort of reminisce mm-hmm. a little bit. Got over to England, and of the group of us who went to UK, eight went to HMS Devonshire, which was a county-class cruiser, and two of us went to HMS Norfolk, which was a sister ship. Now, at that time, Norfolk was in Newcastle on Tyne, being repaired after the where she had knocked about, Scharnhorst. deal. And the officer in charge of midshipman's training, who was the navigator,
mm-hmm.
was a very keen young officer. And the last thing he wanted was some new, brand new midshipman sculling around the ship in refit.
Oh, wide-eyed and bushy-tailed.
So he very sensibly, I think, and for me very luckily, he arranged for the two of us to in fact go to motor torpedo boats.
Just because of the alphabetical business?
No,
again?
No, it's just, by the time the RM were doing it, it's just the luck of the draw.
Okay.
So my friend and I, we went off to Lowestoft, to what was known as HMS Mantis, and served for about 2 months in motor torpedo boats. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, if you go to a real small ship, all of a sudden you've got a job to do, as opposed to being a makey learnie and sort of always sort of being on the receiving end of instruction. And so we had two very good months in MTBs, where we were in fact were doing a series of patrols known as Z patrols, and don't ask me why there were Z patrols, off the east coast of England. And the plan there was that the coastal convoys running up and down the east coast of England, mostly coal from the north down to the power stations in the south, would be savaged by E-boats coming across from the other side. And so they, by this time radar of course had appeared mm-hmm. on the scene, and so what they would do, they would put a frigate with radar with two pairs of MTBs, one about 10 miles north of them and one about a pair of 10 miles south. And it'd be rather like then a fighter control, aircraft control problem. If the frigate detected approaching E-boats on his radar, then he would vector his MTBs out to intercept and take them into battle. So we spend a hell of a lot of time sitting out there with engine stopped, just waiting for the other guy to turn up.
And you'd be a second officer then, is that
yeah.
correct?
So by this time I'd be sort of standing my watch on the bridge, you know, waiting for sort of somebody to come up on radio and say, you know, go. And
was it what you had hoped? You'd mentioned before that just to be in command,
yeah.
of a ship or at least...
Well, have a responsible job, you see, and this was it. I mean, all of a sudden you were standing there and you had sort of officer watch duties. Now, mark you, I mean, the captain wasn't very far away, nor was the first time, because in those boats, I mean, you sailed just before sunset
mm-hmm.
and came back at dawn, so you're only at sea for, say, 12 hours. So really, nobody really worried about sleeping too much.
What rank would the captain of the ship be at this point?
Lieutenant.
Two-bar lieutenant.
Yeah, and the sub-lieutenant would be the XO, and then there'd be me. And most of the boats had a midshipman of one sort or another. And there'd be a coxswain and about 12 men. And they were 71-foot high-speed motorboats, you know, 45 knots,
mm-hmm.
go like the clappers, carry two torpedo tubes, and... three pounder gun on the front end. I guess. Look up my journal. even got a dreadful sketch of one. And I think I had. Yeah. Oh God, don't tell me I haven't got a sketch. I thought I did.
The ones up, you don't have a sketch of.
Yeah. Oh well. So that really sort of filled in the early days. Well, then by the time they got the Norfolk back online,
did you see any action in the small boats, or was it just a question of
we got a couple of times we chased after something we thought was the E-boats, but really never knew where they were or not. the only time we got shot at and got hit was by an American Liberty ship, who thought we were E-boats. So he shot at us and he put a hole through the front end, which paid off rather well because it put us on the slips for about 5 days while they patched it up. And he was very apologetic, so he gave the boat a crate of eggs and crate of oranges and lots of cigarettes and a few goodies that we hadn't seen. And
it was like gold over
that
there.
It was like gold, right? Yeah.
Sure.
So that was right.
Tremendous.
But I say, that was good fun.
And you went back to the HMS Norfolk.
Then went to Norfolk. And she was based up in Scapa Flow as part of the home fleet. And the commander-in-chief was in the Rodney. And we carried the flag of the Rear Admiral commanding the 1st Cruiser Squadron. So we were a flagship, Cruiser Squadron flagship. And
so they had to be spit and polished.
Oh, yeah. I mean, even though the war was on, I mean, all the brass was polished and, boats ran all tiddly and, marine band and bugles and all the good stuff, capital ship routine, And we, do a fair amount of sea time going out and doing gunnery shoots and practicing, but really just waiting, for some operation to be generated. And we did a number of operations off the Norwegian coast and shot up a couple of German convoys running up and down the coast. Did the last raid on the Lofoten Islands when we escorted one of the carriers up to the Lofoten Islands. That was the last major strike of the war in the North Sea area. Also, I got my first crossing of the Arctic Circle on that one. And then just before VE Day, they were afraid that the Prince Eugen and the Deutschland, I guess, one of the pocket battleships and one of the big crews, not the Prince Eugen, Prince Eugen?
Yes.
One of the big crews. They were afraid that they might make a wild, suicidal dash out of the Baltic through the Skagerrak and out into the North Sea and just do a final crazy sort of shoot-up. So they put a series of British cruisers in the approaches. So I ended up spending VE Day at sea waiting for the enemy that never came out.
What was VE Day like at sea?
Same as any other day, really, other than,
get an extra tot of rum or what?
Yeah, they splice the main brace. And, of course, that's the only time when officers get issued a tot of rum. And so we all had our tot of rum, and, of course, there was great rejoicing. But, I mean, the guns crew stayed up, closed up, and the directors were closed up, and the ship remained at, not action stations, because we would normally steam in a cruising action station, which was sort of third degree of readiness.
Mm-hmm.
But up until VE Day, we in fact stayed in the second degree of readiness. As soon as VE Day was announced, then we reverted to the third degree, but we still kept sort of one third of the armament closed up just in case. And we stayed out there until, I guess, the day after VE Day, where this time the troops, the shore people had got into Kiel.
Mm-hmm.
And knew the ships weren't going to sail. And then we came back to the UK and went back to Recife and had about 24 hours there. And then we, then we sailed for Bergen with two destroyers. And we were the liberating force for Bergen in Norway. And we went in there and did our, 4-day visit, I guess. Which is all very strange because the Germans were still sort of marching around town and, and going ashore on leave, and we were all going ashore on leave, and, everybody was sort of coming together in the same place. But they kept pretty low profile attack. Didn't see much of it. There was one excitement when one of the submarines sailed into the middle of the fjord and submerged, and we all went to action stations. Anyhow, he bobbed up again, and the admiral, who was a guy called Roderick MacGregor, who stood about 5'5", I guess, a little guy, super guy, very bushy eyebrows. Anyhow, he sent for the German U-boat commandant, and I guess he'd be a four-stripe captain or a commodore, who it turned out to be a man about 6'3" or 6'4". And story goes he just tore this guy up one side and down the other for allowing his U-boat to sail, and the excuse was it went out to swing compasses or something. But we had the proverbial sort of thing that Brits do so well, the children's party on the ship and ice cream and roundabouts on the captain and all that sort of good.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really back to sort of the pre-war port visit, open the ship to visitors,
show
the flag and all the good stuff. And then we went back from that and had about another 24-hour turnaround, and then embarked the Norwegian royal family and took them back to Oslo. So we took the King and Queen of Norway back. And that would be, I don't know, about the 10th of May. I could find out if I could find it in here. But you know, it was not a spectacular European war, but it was interesting.
You feel cheated at all?
No, I think I was very satisfied. I guess, you know, we all would like to have become more involved. But on the other hand, it certainly wasn't dull, you know.
No.
We had a fair amount of Scapa Flow time, which, you know, is certainly not the most favorite and most scenic place in the world. You know, Scapa Flow is really a bit of the end of the world. Where are we? June the 5th, I guess. Yeah, June the 5th, 1945, we embarked the Norwegian royal family. King Haakon the 7th.
Your duties remained the same?
Yeah, it was a continuing training program. Bridge watches, navigation training, pilot training, damage control, ship stability, gunnery torpedoes, you know, the whole thing, but in a practical sense. Coupled with duties like midshipman of the watch in harbor, running boats. Midshipmen were always assigned to the motorboat, so you, in a sense you could say that a motorboat was probably, in a sense, your first command. You know, you would have, you'd be assigned to this boat, you would have a leading seaman as a coxswain, a stoker, a bowman, and a stern sheetsman. So you had sort of a crew of four and you, and you ran this boat, and you have to look after it and make sure the crew cleaned it and scrubbed it and made it work and run it according to, well, whatever the instructions you got and so on.
How did it feel as a midshipman in that your coxswain probably had forgotten more about seamanship and had been brought up in the naval tradition than you ever had, or did they realize the position you were in and looked after you, or what was the situation
this,
there?
This, I guess, is one of the greatest pluses for the midshipman as a rank and a position. The permanent force sailor, from the ordinary seaman right the way through to admirals, knew exactly where the midshipman fitted into the scheme of things. The whole world knew he was there to learn. Result was that it didn't matter who it was, you could ask the question. If you didn't know how to tie a bowline, you could ask a leading seaman and he wouldn't think any the less of you, because he knew you were a midshipman and you were there to learn.
Learn.
I've always felt that by abolishing the midshipman within our own RCN training program, which happened, I guess, really about integration time, you took away this lovely position of the midshipman. He was neither officer nor man. He was in between.
Fish nor fowl.
Neither fish nor fowl, that's right. The moment you put a stripe on the guy's arm, the man, particularly the junior man, the less experienced man, would tend to think, why is he asking that dumb question? He's an officer, he should know, because he's got a stripe. And I still feel that there's, you know, for putting the right emphasis and the right status on a position, the midshipman with a superb rank to have.
Well, wasn't it always said that one doesn't salute the man, one salutes the rank of the uniform? I guess that would, if a guy doesn't know, then he shouldn't be holding that rank.
That's
I
right.
guess would follow through, like what you're saying,
sir.
Yeah. That's good. That's interesting. You stayed as a midshipman until April 1946, when you were promoted sub-lieutenant.
Yeah, acting sub-lieutenant. And then went off to do these technical courses. Now, there was didn't do the whole time in Norfolk. The 20-month midshipman time was 14 months in big ships, and then 6 months in destroyers and small ships. And as I mentioned, there were two of us in Norfolk.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the time we had come to the end of the 14 months in the big ship and we'd sat our, our seamanship exams, which is the big one, and so on, the ship by this time was out in the Far East. And in fact, we were south of Singapore. So then...
Was the war still going at this point?
No, we had now been through VE Day, we had been through VJ Day. But we had been on the way out to the Far East when VJ Day came along.
So you were anticipating the East, I gather, in that you could still get a piece of that?
Right,
or?
Right. But we stopped in Malta on the way for a refit. By the time we'd finished the refit, that lot was over. So VJ Day I spent in Malta. So then we moved from Norfolk to the first of the small ships that we were supposed to go to, which was Minesweepers.
Mm-hmm.
So we were sent to Penang in Malaya, where we joined the 6th Minesweeping Squadron, or flotilla, to do minesweeping. And they were sweeping up mines in the Malacca Straits that run between Malaya on one side and Sumatra on the west side. And we were supposed to, we found out afterward, we were supposed to be in those ships for about 6 to 8 weeks, and then be moved to Far East Fleet Destroyers, and I was supposed to go to the Cheviot. But somewhere along the way, the message got lost, and we never did get the message telling us to report to Destroyers.
So as a midshipman, you didn't make Destroyers.
So I never got Destroyers as midshipman. On the other hand, again, by luck, like the MTBs, we ended up in Minesweepers, which were shorthanded, and so instead of being a very low man on the totem pole, in fact, there was a real job to do.
Yeah.
And we would minesweep Monday to Friday, and probably Saturday, and maybe go in for half a Saturday or just Sunday. And minesweeping is a very demanding task, in that the one thing you've got to do right is to keep station. Because if you get out of station, you move out of the swept water of the ship ahead of you, and you could end up into the minefield. So that was tremendous experience for us to get this training. And of course, it was a hell of a good training in seamanship, because minesweeping is primarily seamanship. It's not gunnery, it's not torpedoes, it's handling wires and paravanes and davits and all this sort of thing. So it was good seamanship training. It was excellent sort of off-to-the-watch station keeping, ship handling experience. So instead of getting 6 weeks of it, we got... it must have been close to four to four and a half months of it. And then finally they found out where we were and then said, right, it's time to go back to UK for such courses. And so we trooped back in the big fleet carrier, the Indomitable, just as passengers. I think we stood, one watch in 30 or something ridiculous. It was always difficult to remember when you were going to be on watch, is it Wednesday or Friday, And then back to UK, of course.
That must have been experience going from a small
essence. Yeah, a small minesweeper to that. Yeah.
This football stadium,
yeah.
On the water.
Right.
My gosh. You stay, according to my record here.
Your cheat sheet.
My cheat sheet. You're promoted to sub lieutenant in 46. Yet in 47. You're promoted to full lieutenant, naval lieutenant, which is 2 bar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, was that not a quick promotion?
Well, I forget how many months I earned. Remember I talked about 2 years less number of months you earned for your...
specialty training?
Your courses,
mm-hmm.
So much free to pass or first class or whatever.
You did extremely well in your...
So I zonked a few off there, and so I did about a year as a sub lieutenant. And then you were right, you see, in those days, it was 8 years as a lieutenant.
Right.
Or 2-stripe lieutenant, come hell or high water. It was 8 years, no more, no less. And then it was automatic promotion to lieutenant commander. And then it was by selection from lieutenant commander to commander, and commander to captain. Since then, they moved it down and it became a selection process from lieutenant to lieutenant commander. But at the same time, they reduced the time. So you entered the zone for promotion to lieutenant commander down to 6 years. So the bright guys, in fact, would make lieutenant commander after 6 years, lieutenant rather than eight. But nowadays it was straight automatic. You knew that, I think my date was 15th of September 1947, and I knew on the 15th of September 1955 I was going to be a lieutenant commander.
Very good. 47, you come back, you're a two-bar lieutenant,
mm-hmm.
you're back to the Canadian Forces.
Yeah.
This is quite an adjustment after the Royal Navy and these vast...
Not really, because the regulations, the method of operating, the RCM, was 90% based on the Royal Navy rules and regulations. In fact, in those days, our orders, the orders and instructions were Queen's regulations and Admiralty instructions. Our operating instructions, if you like, were Admiralty fleet orders, technical and operation.
Right.
It was only in about 1948, I guess, 47, 48, that in fact we produced our own KRCN, King's Regulations for the Canadian Navy. Mm-hmm. And we produced our own Naval General Orders, NGOs as we call them.
So that's what I was trying to get at. More than that, though.
The biggest change, of course, was didn't know anybody.
Oh,
we didn't know anybody. We had spent all our time with RN, when I say senior officers, people senior to ourselves, sub-lieutenants and lieutenants and lieutenant commanders and what have you. We had gone straight from Royal Roads, where we had lived in this very isolated sort of world, direct over to UK from the sort of August of 44, didn't get back until February of 47, so that's roughly close to 3 years by the time we got down to our ship and so on. So we arrived there, and other than our own little group who joined the East Coast or the West Coast fleet as sub-lieutenants, didn't know a soul in the Canadian Navy.
I never thought of that.
And of course, at that time, the Canadian Navy was still in the final throes of running down at the end of the war.
This is what I'm trying to get at, with the grind down of the ships.
That's right.
And
we were very small in number, so it didn't take long to get to know people, because in those days, I guess the total RCN was about 7,000 officers and men.
So very big.
So, it didn't take long to certainly know by sight all the officers in Halifax. It didn't take much longer to get to know by sight all the sort of chiefs and petty officers in Halifax, which is where I ended up.
Mm-hmm. You didn't feel that, or you weren't really concerned about your own job security, and that you figured they had enough investment in you?
You see, we didn't feel any sort of hesitation that we were going to be demobilized or let go unless the whole Navy collapsed. Because we figured that the people who would go first out the door would be the RCNVRs and the RCNRs.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they were peeling off pretty rapidly, and only the select few sort of stayed on. And at that time, there was a process of transferring from the reserve to the regular force, and they were having a great series of selection boards and what have you. Now,
escaped all this.
Yeah, because we were there. We were permanent force right from the very beginning.
Plus, the Canadian government had quite an investment in you people.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But I guess the difference really, it didn't really bother us in those days so much, perhaps, that these ex-RCNVR officers were senior to us and what have you, because we were geared to the regular flow. It was going to be so long as a lieutenant and what have you. It was only probably a little later on, when you were getting into the sort of the selectivity process, that I think some of us began to think, well, hell's bells, we've been permanent all the way through, and yet it looks like so many of the ex-reserves are getting the promotions, and we were still sort of soldiering on.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to speculate whether there was a reason behind it or not. I think you could probably do a little speculation and say that perhaps because a lot of the people by this time in the more senior positions were ex-reserve. There might have been a little bit of leaning towards them rather than this unknown group who were in the system. And of course, I mean, following along behind us every year, Royal Roads was graduating about 20 mm-hmm. regular force officers who were coming through the pipeline. And then the next big sort of stage was the expansion when the Korean effort came along.
Yes.
And of course, that was the point in time when instead of expanding around a regular force nucleus of and then using RCNVR people to make the expansion, it was all predicated on a regular force or permanent force navy. So then they increased the intake, or if you like, transfer
mm-hmm.
of the reserves into the permanent force. So all of a sudden you've got a great big swelling of the permanent force. So at a time when we might have been moving into sort of the promotion stakes as a small group, we were now a much bigger group
yeah.
because of the Korean expansion.
Good, I think that's a good place to leave off. Seems 11 o'clock at night. I know you have to work tomorrow morning.
Yeah, I gotta work tomorrow morning.
Thank you very much, sir.